Hi, welcome to Holden Village. In the Creekside Room, today's speaker is Shelley Bob, and she will be speaking on How Did Hitler Respond to the Church? So let's listen in on Shelley.
It'd be fun for me too. Roll the tape. My name is Shelley Bob, and this session is entitled Underground Church Resistance to Hitler. Today we're going to... You said you knew Bonhoeffer from before.
Oh, I just read a couple of books. And,
Yeah, which ones have you?
Look, his Letters from Prison, and one other one I can't remember. It was a long time and recently, unfortunately. But
I have
admiration for him. And finally, a play of his life was put on in Houston by the AD Players, which is kind of a Christian.
Right.
I forgot the name of it. Anyway, it had a catchy name. So, you know, I'm interested in him. I don't know a lot about it.
Yeah.
So, don't assume I know it. Well, you may know a lot about him, I don't know, but...
No.
You know,
no.
Don't take a lot for granted.
Well, this is going to be an introduction. There are so many segments. Yeah, come on in. Sure. There's so many segments to his life and witness and theology. People are only beginning to, in my opinion, they're only beginning to really come to terms with his ethics. But we're not going to do that today. That would be a whole course to do a whole life and understanding the complete theology of Bonhoeffer. So what we're concentrating on this week in the series is resistance to Hitler. So that's what we're going to talk about with Bonhoeffer. But just as a brief overview, I was just asking who's familiar with Bonhoeffer.
Yeah.
Do you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Read that a long time ago, but read it.
Yeah. It stays with you, though. You remember he was born to a wealthy kind of upper crust German family and experienced what we would call a rather elite education. And in Germany, you know, education's pretty good, and if it's elite, it's even better. He traveled to the United States, and the person that taught me first about Bonhoeffer described him as kind of a spoiled brat when he came over here, which was the only bad description I've ever heard of him. He was a rich kid. He bought a car and cruised all around drinking beer and with his buddies all around sections of the United States. Now,
was he studying or just visiting?
Well, he's going to study, too, in New York City at Union Seminary. But I thought, well, if he's in his early 20s or late, I mean, I thought, I might do that. I mean, that doesn't sound too weird to get a bunch of people if you're going to a place to study and have a few months and have some fun first.
I think I read something by a sister, and I think that... maybe he did that in the United States because Germans will do that. But my dad grew up in a Parsons family, and that family was very similar. It was a large family, and they were very loving to each other, from what I read anyway.
Yeah, he
so
did.
So he might have been that way coming to the U.S.
Well,
that's not how he grew up. He was really in a good family.
Oh, he grew up in an extraordinarily tight, loving family that practiced devotions and had music, and meals were occasions for great fellowship, and family was extraordinarily important, as was the faith. And I think that's really evident in his book, Papers and Letters from Prison, that was published after he died, was martyred on April 9th, 1945. He was in a plot to kill Hitler, which got him in a lot of trouble. He said that Hitler was a snake whose head needed to be bit off. So he and a few other people, some relatives, in fact, of his, went underground and had a plot to assassinate Hitler. They were caught. He was imprisoned for about 2 years, and on April 9th, 1945, he was hung. And, or I guess we could even say he was martyred. And the liberation came days afterwards. Mm-hmm. So we've missed, we have him still in his formative, I think his very formative years with his ethics and cost of discipleship. His ethics is maybe his most sophisticated theological book, but he's just getting rolling, you know. But what I wanted to say about him being in the United States was he had enjoyed the time that he spent at Union Theological Seminary in New York, which at that time was a rich place to be. And he was considered a brilliant young student. And he was offered to stay there on full scholarship, but he said no. He had to go back to Germany. This was about 1931, 32, and be with his people, knowing that his involvement would probably lead him into, as he put it, God only knows. So he could have stayed and left. Hi.
And saved his skin.
Yeah, he could and lived a very nice life. And in fact, Paul Tillich pleaded with him to stay. Don't go back, because if you go back, you're only going to get in trouble, because I think he knew the kind of what kind of theological cloth he was cut out of. But he did go back, and that's where he got involved with some things. So I want to talk about, we're talking about Dietrich Bonhoeffer today. So I'd like to talk, there's so much we could say about him, but today we're going to just take kind of a snapshot of one of the things that he did, which I think was wildly resistive. Not only plotting to kill somebody is resistive, but this is resistive as well. We're going to talk about his seminary that he started called Finkenwald, the name of my first child. No, when I hit these German names, I was like, what? I'm still consider myself new to translating German, and the names still
boggle you.
Yeah, they still get me. I still find myself shaking my head. And it was only in operation for 2 years, but becomes one of the centers for a deep confessional place to find faith. And I'd just like to look at some of the trouble he got in today starting that and some of the things that he implemented in it. And then I hope the last little bit we can kick it up to where the church is today. It's really a very simple thing, you can almost imagine. The background of seminaries, now some of you have been in the other sessions we've had. What would you think the back, just from, just let your, take a stab at what you think the background of a normal seminary life or curriculum would be in Germany, pre-war Germany.
Probably pretty academic.
Right.
Heavy duty.
Very academic.
Study. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, probably pretty rigid and formal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
A lot of language study and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And text study.
That's right. Who would they be run by, the church or the state?
Well, it's the state, really.
Yep.
Maybe really nationalistic.
Yes, they would.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Because the state pays, you know, they're really servants of
this.
Yeah, they're agents of the state, but they were really great academic institutions.
So
Walt, didn't Walt go to, did
they were all on universities. Walt was at Heidelberg.
Yeah?
After the war.
After the war, so things were changed by then. Yeah.
55.
Yeah, that would be a little different, but this is before. What were you going to say?
I was just going to say, so his must have been independent, right?
Well, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he didn't get.
That's probably why they fought.
Yeah.
He didn't get any state support or anything.
No, we're going to get into that. I just wanted to talk about what he had to do, because
sure.
They were into state-supported stuff. Now, once the Germans come to power and Ludwig Miller, the Reich bishop, is elected in 1933, they're really going to have a different agenda, that the German Christian agenda that we've talked about before, and that meant that you supported the Führer and the state. Well, Bonhoeffer couldn't stand for that, so he started his own seminary. And immediately they had to go underground. There wasn't even, you know, one day of reprieve. And in his biographies that I have read and studied, the word miracle keeps coming up to describe what Finkenwald ended up to be. It was a miracle it even survived for 2 years. I mean, the Nazis could sniff out anything they wanted to in that time period, and their organizational prowess was incredible. It was a miracle it survived that long. Because underground, you might think it was, you know, in somebody's basement, you know, and they only met at night with candles or something. This is a picture of it.
Oh.
I mean, it's a pretty nice little place. So we talk about it being underground, but everybody kind of knew about it, but that meant also that it operated independent of a university system or the state. So
why was it left alone?
Well, we're going to talk about that.
Well, was it then just sort of like a front of some sort? I mean,
no.
They kept it a secret or what?
Well, they didn't really keep it a secret. They people knew it was around, but the German Christians were bending over backwards, and so was Hitler at that time, to try to keep the church happy, because he knew if the church revolted, what would happen? Things could fall apart.
Underground is really just away from the universities.
That's exactly right. Yeah, that's why I want to show you the picture. It's above ground. It's not exactly secret. They don't have a secret discipline. You know, you hear communities mm-hmm. having that or different mm-hmm. groups. It's not a secret discipline, and it's not a secret. It's underground because it's separate.
And it was in this grace period where Hitler was still ruling the church.
Right.
So that gave them this ability to get by with it.
That's right. And there were members of the Confessing Church that we talked about a little bit yesterday. It was an offshoot from the Pastors Emergency League. And you remember people in the Confessing Church also were members of the Nazi Party. So there's still not a clear delineation what's going on. So he can operate. But if you're underground, that means you get... what's a big deal right now in colleges and universities?
Money.
Yeah. You aren't going to get any money from the state or support. And as over the 2 years, the drum rolls do start rolling and things become more threatening. We'll talk about that as it goes along. So when I say they're forced underground, that's why I wanted to show you the picture. They're not beaten in somebody's basement with the boiler next door in the canned peaches. They're in a pretty nice place. And it was at a time where the Confessing Church was kind of reaching its heyday. That organization was really good, and they thought they had a mission, and they knew what they were doing. So they could, you remember too, they supported people who were in trouble and who were confessing the faith. So they supported Bonhoeffer's seminary. So that's where although he was underground, he wasn't alone. He had... You remember by January 1934, I think it was, there were 7,000 pastors in the Confessing Church. So he had a lot of backup of his own kind, but the state is still against him. One of the first things Bonhoeffer decides when he gets there, and the more I read of him and his stuff, he was what you might call a very controlling person, but I think you need that sometimes. I'm grateful when somebody sees chaos and takes control. And I've sensed even in my pastoral life that sometimes you have to do that. You have to do it. Well, he doesn't. And I know maybe you all in your professions and vocations as parents and spouses, sometimes you do have to take control, right? Well, he does. And he sets up a very disciplined life. He can only do this because people have given him lots of money. They've supported him. He has a theological reputation that won't quit. And they also are sending him gifts constantly. One of the funniest stories is that he was teaching a class and received notification that a pig was being delivered in an hour, and he would have to go get this pig from the train station. So he got a group of students down, and they got it, and they threw the pig in the back seat of this car, brought the pig up, and then they had to butcher it, because it wasn't for a pet. Some farmer sent it that wanted to help out some farmer pastor. So they had to get a permit to butcher this pig, and that was a hassle to get the permit, and they finally obtained the permit and then butchered the pig, and they had a big party over it. But people sent them all kinds of stuff, but the pig story is one of my favorites. Kind of indicative of how people, you know, want to help out. Here's kind of how he set this up, and it's going to be very important for later on, but we'll just talk about it. He started out the day with the service of the word at the dinner table. There was no chapel. Everything was done in the dining hall. Now, what do you think that says?
Community, I guess.
Yeah.
Food around the food.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Gather around the table.
There was no chapel.
That may have been too obvious.
Yeah.
I mean, if they'd had an altar and a candle or whatever.
The cross somewhere.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
The cross, right.
Right.
Yeah, but I think it comes out of his family, too, because
Yeah. then too.
Very good, very good. He cherishes table fellowship and wants the life together to be one. I think I read something that Carol Hinderly talked. He really didn't, was this right? I read it kind of quickly. Didn't want to have necessarily a chapel built here, because he said the whole place should be a church, a chapel. And I think Bonhoeffer had the same idea. So they met after their, I can't remember if it was before or after their morning meal. They had service of the word, and that included a psalm, a hymn, a New Testament reading, a prayer, and the Lord's Prayer. And then they started class. Now, classes were fairly normal for what a seminary would have, and we'll talk about those a little bit later. And then they had lunch. There was a big discussion, a big conflict in the seminary, because Bonhoeffer wanted to replace it. He had been to the States for a while and didn't want the heavy German lunch. He wanted to have a light lunch instead. But they went back to heavy lunches. More classes and then service of the word. And what he would do is have a continual reading of what happened in the morning to at night, and then the next morning. It was the Anglican method. So the biblical scripture wasn't disjointed. So you got through the whole Book of Mark. You didn't hop around. One evening a week, there was a political discussion, which Bonhoeffer thought was very important to have, which he led, and he only preached on Saturdays. And in his writings and diaries, he says he preached straightforwardly, directly, and short. What we all pray for preaching, especially short. This discipline, at first, was not enjoyed by people. But after a while, they came to get into the rhythm of it. And later on, when these people are in jail, these seminarians, persecuted, they continued it and said that it was because of this arcane discipline, you know that old Latin phrase, the disciplina arcana, this old discipline that they had, they could survive in the cells, they could survive in jail, and they kept that discipline up. So what does that say to you? It says something to me, but I...
Well, it's something, when you got chaos around you, having some tie to the past, when things were orderly, and to maintain that order in your life, it helps you remember who you are,
yeah,
why you are.
Good, yeah. He also encouraged memorization. How would that help you? How many people like to memorize? Oh.
Well, it would keep you from going nuts, I think.
Yeah, because they deprive you of books.
Right. Yeah. I mean, how reassuring to be able to say the Psalms in prison to yourself if you weren't given a Bible, to be able to say those words.
Yeah.
They said out of all the gifts, seminarians, not one or a couple of them died, but not too many, and they've written books about their time with Bonhoeffer. They said one of the best gifts he gave them was this discipline. Now, there's a lot of talk in seminaries now today about theological education. I think they're making some big decisions. I don't quite know where things are going to end up. But the word discipline, I don't know if it enters in much to the discussion. But I find this interesting. Huh? What?
This is pertinent to, I need to hear this today.
Oh, I don't know. And I don't know how something like this would fly where I went to school. I mean, I can see people saying, yeah, right. they just said you should go to chapel, but nobody ticked your name off if you, you know, decided to go fly.
Well, he ticked names off. He wanted them all there, right?
There was no option. Should wasn't even, it was and ought. It should moved. What's the next ethical imperative? Move to ought. Move to you have
we are
to.
There.
Yeah,
you're there.
We
are there.
Right.
No, nothing else.
Yeah. This is where the community gathers.
Are you going to mention how many students he had at different times?
Mm-hmm. Well, the top heavy it was about 300, I think.
Really? That many?
No, I mean, that was over the course.
Oh, okay.
No.
Well,
I'm sorry.
That was only 3 years or 2 years.
Yeah, 25 mm-hmm. about. And there were women students, too. So this is in 1935, and I don't know how many women students were at Luther Northwestern in 1935. How many were at Trinity, Jan? Do you know how many?
They started in 1970.
Yeah, but I think they could take courses before that, but yeah, they couldn't get... Yeah.
There was no ordination at that time for women?
Not for women, no. But women did play an important part. In fact, one of the people we talked about yesterday, Stephanie von Mackensen, they said that without her and her theology and backing, that Finkenwald wouldn't have pulled off. So you have this discipline, and this is going to be one of the cornerstones for the whole seminary experience. And it's the thing that the seminarians pointed back to that was so critical to them. Do we need to say anything more about, do you have any more opinions about that? You just said...
Well, I'm just thinking of, teaching mold modalities and how they changed. I don't know, where there's more of an emphasis on lack of structure, possibly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I guess... unless you've experienced that kind of regimented discipline, in some kind of a, you don't really know the full value of it until you go through it.
What are some of the values of discipline, and in particular this kind of discipline, would you think? If any of you play an instrument or have kids or have learned
really,
another language,
it becomes
studied.
Second nature to you. Mm-hmm. It goes into your unconscious, and it also sets your mind freed up for creativity in other ways too.
Right.
Well, if you have kids or something, I like to do some writing, and you have to be disciplined to do that. You have to make the time.
Right.
It doesn't appear. And I think for children it's important to see someone taking time to do something and over a long period of time, that mm-hmm. it doesn't just appear or happen.
Good. You.
I just always think of discipline helping me a lot with obedience. In other words, if I'm disciplined, then I seem to be, it's easy for me to be obedient to, particularly to the Lord in my day-by-day service and prayer and
good. Mm-hmm. So the discipline has a fruit mm-hmm. of obedience to good. Well, this is one of the cornerstones of his seminary, and something that when you discuss his seminary, you really can't overlook at all, because it just doesn't change. And he sets it up. He is the chair and secretary and vice president of the board of directors at his seminary, so he set it up by himself. Let's look at some of the other earmarks of this too. One of the things he talked about was there would be no discussion of other people if Bonhoeffer wasn't present. In other words, I can't talk about you, although I might want to, in a negative way unless you're there. And then I can. And then later he modified that to say, I can't talk about you unless Bonhoeffer's there and you are there. Mm-hmm. Now, why would that be important for a group of seminarians who are about 25 people, or any group, 3 or 100 people? We have about I don't know, how many people are in the village now? About 120?
Well, you'd keep from triangulating, and you'd keep from people splitting off from each other. Those are psych terms, but they're
yep.
you keep more of a. But if you want to talk about me, and I'm not present, then I can't speak for myself, and
right.
I don't know what's going on. And if you've got everybody together, everyone's hearing the same discussion. At least you're hoping they are, and that there is the sense of being able to deal with conflict
right.
openly,
right,
without the factions starting to happen, which happens really quickly if you don't do that.
That's right. Well, he saw that, and he said it's a rule, and if I find you breaking it, it was one of the few rules that you were out. That's one of his things. I think it's a great rule to live by.
And he's very progressive in that respect.
Yeah.
He's a systems thinker. No.
Yeah, he was. What commandment is he dealing with here? Do you remember? I don't care about the number so much, although if you know the number, you get extra points.
False witnessing.
Right, right.
Ultimately.
Right, very.
Also the golden rule.
Yeah, yeah. So that becomes very important to him. So again, he's trying to build here more than just a place of learning, but he's trying to build a community. And he does it through disciplines and laws, but sometimes you have to have that. There's no classwork on Sunday. You cannot pick up a pen or read a book for class on Sunday. And he has gobs of recreation. He loves to hike and climb and swim. He was a real, it reminds me when I read about him, like the Kennedys, you know, he just liked to do all this physical stuff. And his family was like that where he grew up. And also he loved music. He was an excellent musician himself, and they had two concert grand pianos at Finkenwald, and they were used constantly. And he also loved hymns and loved singing. But there was no classwork on Sunday. Now, what would that say to you? And this ties in a little bit with what Dorothy Bass has been talking about, too, about the Sabbath.
And so the church was on Saturday. They didn't have church on Sunday.
Right, right. He had it on Saturday nights.
One day off.
Playtime.
Rest. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Recreation. Pardon me, what does Finkenwald mean? Do you have any idea?
No, I don't.
Oh, Vald means forest, and
yeah.
They have Fink.
Oh, Vald is fink.
Yeah,
right.
Fink is a bird. Finkenwald is, those are like finches.
Mm-hmm. Bird forest.
Finch Forest, huh?
Wow. That's kind of a sweet
name. Was it the
name
of the community, or he just named it that?
It might be a community.
Probably a little.
I think it was a little town where he was.
Yeah.
And
I like the Anglo-Saxon word W-O-L-D. You've heard that Wold. W-O-L-D.
Yeah.
So it's closely related to that.
Mm-hmm. Huh.
Yeah, I mean, he probably wouldn't. Doesn't sound very theological. I don't think he made it up. It doesn't sound very theological.
Well, since it was underground, he probably, again, just didn't want something too obvious.
Like, yeah.
You know, like an institute or
whatever. Yeah.
University.
Yeah.
All campus.
The name of the town.
Probably just a town.
Yeah.
The town.
Village or something.
One of the problems with just doing, I don't know German. Well, I'm learning it pretty well from translating, but I just do theological German. So when somebody says, well, what does this mean? And they show me like a restaurant guide or something. And I'm going over there in a couple of weeks to go to the Berlin Document Center for about a month. I want a scholarship. And I'm worried about eating out. I'll be fine in the Document Center with the theological stuff. My theological German is now pretty good. But
the Wiener Schnitzel, that's all you
need. I thought I'm going to eat hot dogs the whole time and drink beer. I don't know what else.
No,
I need to work.
Trial and error.
Yeah.
Order
yeah.
Something and discover maybe that's not what you should order.
Well, I got to learn some words for greens, you know, so I can. Anyway. But
let the waiter help you. They love it.
I will. I'm not worried about it. It's just kind of. I was just. When you said that, I thought, this has become. It's a practical problem right now.
You probably won't see German food anyway. The best food is Turkish and other things. Like
oh, really?
That.
Okay, I'll go eat Chinese or something. They're all over. No, I'll be fine. It's just something that struck me. I'm dealing with this. It's just kind of funny. Now, Bonhoeffer visited a Baptist seminary where they had to take an oath that when they came, this is kind of a comical oath almost, but it has an important implication. When they came through the door of the Baptist seminary, when your foot crossed the threshold, you had to be and act with a behavior that was becoming a member of the pastoral roster. Mm. Well, at my seminary, we didn't do that all the time. As I remember, maybe things have changed, but he didn't want them to take an oath. But what he did was tried to model that. And one of the stories that's constantly told was in the first month it was open, they were at table and somebody didn't show up for the dish team. And the cook came out and asked for volunteers. So all these guys and these women are sitting around and they're kind of dressed up, they all wear ties and stuff. No one volunteered because it was kind of considered a lowly job. Without saying a word, the biographer says, without saying a word, Bonhoeffer got up, took off his tie, rolled up his sleeves, and went up and did all the dishes for the community. And no one said a word. So he tried to model how you should be. So they weren't made to take an oath. With all this discipline, you might think so, but they were made to take an oath. Seminarians.
Did they start doing the dishes after
that? Yes, they did. Yes, they did. In fact, the story goes on. It's kind of a cute story. There's so much little stories about Bonhoeffer because he's so beloved. I think in history, in the church or whatever pocket it is, that somebody's beloved when you know teeny stories like this. But the story trails on to say that he went down then to the beach and found his students there, and they were so ashamed they couldn't even bring themselves to say, hey, I'll do it next time. Like, no one could even speak because they all felt so small. But some of the seminarians were involved with the Nazi military, and I drew this stupid picture, I'm not a very good drawer, of the church and the crown. That's a crown. And they felt it was important to be a member of the Nazi party or a part of the military. Why would they think that?
Well, they're Germans.
Right.
No, I think you got to split it down. I'm a former German, so I'm going to defend my former native country. There were many people in the Nazi party who had positions of power, and they were not Nazis. This is something you need to understand. There are the real Nazis, and there were the people that joined to stay in the power structure. And a lot of these people were... some of them were even royalists. In other words, they were linked to the former regime, and believed in that. And because they were royalists, they were about as opposite as you could get. There were many people like that, including the man that was hanged with Bonhoeffer, Admiral Canaris, who I think Hitler saved those two people because he felt they betrayed him the most. Canaris was very close.
Well, they were high in the political establishment.
Absolutely, right? Yes, they
absolutely
were.
Yeah, and so they thought we have to stay here to fight what's going on.
Exactly, and they wanted to show that the confessing church or a movement within it, this seminary, could be faithful to its Lord and be a good political member at the same time. And by staying in the army and being part of the military was a way to show that. And they wanted to show that to demonstrate that.
Was that naive of them?
Huh?
Was that naive of them?
At the time, but you have to understand that it was being a member of the political party was very important.
They didn't know what the agenda was at that point.
No.
They might have. The reason that they were able to even attempt to assassinate Hitler was because...
Well, that's later on. I'm just talking about Finkenwald. Yeah, go ahead.
They were in the... many of them were in the...
Right.
Higher up in the authority.
Later on, they do know. They've cracked what they call the code, and they do know what's going on, and that's why Bonhoeffer says that Hitler's a snake and his head has to be bit off.
Do you think that was premeditated, though? You're suggesting that they might have known to kind of like be a spy within the system?
Well, I think that they were in the political high echelon, what do you call it, high echelon.
Yeah.
And then discovered what Hitler was and
then
made those decisions.
Right.
I think.
Absolutely.
They were some of the leaders.
But that's...
That's why Hitler was so angry and got them killed.
Right. That's a bit later, but...
Mm-hmm. This is really more of a state involvement, too, because, the church itself, the German church, was split on this issue. There were a lot of royalists in it.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Like my grandfather, who suddenly had to retire because he made a few remarks off the pulpit,
We talked yesterday about people who came out from preaching their services and found their suitcases sitting on the steps.
What were the remarks that you made?
Yeah.
Well, something,
Do you have to go, Jan?
Something.
Okay. Okay.
Against the Nazis.
We want to do his first thing.
Well, it did tie in. It was like...
Oh, well, go ahead.
Yeah, I just was curious to know, like, what... For people who were naive about the Nazi agenda, you know, where would they get tripped up with this? You know, if they were involved, you know, what would get them in trouble?
Well, this is 19-1.
It's still a little early.
Yeah.
I mean, okay. You're still safe. Were we to take another day or two with Bonhoeffer, we'll be able to see where he becomes more angry and cannot abide by anything. But right now, he's trying to work within the system. The seeds started to be planted from Hitler against the Confessing Church. By the way, tomorrow we're going to talk about one of the biggest things that the Confessing Church did, and it was at a little town called Barmen, and their declaration and confessional statement they made there. But this is a biography of Bonhoeffer, one of the most famous, in fact, by his relative and very close friend Eberhard Bethge, and it's still one of the standards. It's written in a very confusing way, though. There right now are two other ones out that may be a little bit better, but this is still the classic one. The letter had been sent out, and it said that the Confessing Church has shown no sympathy for the millions who are suffering injustice. This is a letter from Karl Barth, and who was a very famous theologian and at the time, and Bonhoeffer. The Confessing Church has shown no sympathy for the millions who are suffering injustice. She has not spoken out on the most simple matters of public integrity. And if and when she does speak, it is always on her own behalf. So there's starting to be, within the Confessing Church, how would you say it, a breakdown in everybody getting along and understanding they have the same idea. And so the Confessing Church is going to start not to support Finkenwald so much anymore, which means that money will be withdrawn and they become more vulnerable. The Nazis at that time started publishing that there were heresies going on at Finkenwald. And what would those heresies be, do you think? The word heresy is kind of strong, but that's the word they use. That's a German word, I know.
I guess maybe against the state, being against the state or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's the system.
Yeah. That they were...
All the commandment to obey the authorities, maybe?
Right, right. That was basically it. So this was about in 1936 that trouble started, and they started publishing that they were, that Finkenwald was involved with heresies. Of the two classes that were taught at the seminary, homiletics, which is the study of preaching or the teaching of preaching, and confessions were two that Bonhoeffer wouldn't let anybody else teach. He used to get theorists to come in and talk about homiletics, but when it came time to talk about how to really put a sermon together and have people practice, he insisted on hands-on. What do you think that demonstrates, besides a guy that knew what he wanted to do?
Didn't trust what was going on.
Right.
Yeah.
And what was important to him then?
I guess that the gospel be preached. Huh?
Right, that the gospel be preached. I could just read a teeny, is that a zero or? 365. Yeah, okay. Do not, this is what he says to preacher, do not try to make the Bible relevant. It's relevant, it's axiomatic. Do not defend God's words, but testify to it. Trust to the word. It is a ship loaded to the very limits of her capacity. That's kind of fun language. In 1935, the door starts to close. I don't know why I put that up there, because I already said that right away, as soon as they opened, the door started to close. And Jeremiah 45 became a very important passage to Bonhoeffer. I'm going to let, would one of you read this?
Sure.
I don't have my reading glasses on either.
Good. I'm glad somebody else understands this issue.
Just that short chapter?
Yeah.
Whole chapter.
Well, no, wait. It's got some movie stuff in the beginning there. Just start with verse 2. Yeah.
Okay. Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, to you, O Baruch, you said, woe is me, for the Lord has added sorrow to my pain. I am weary with groaning, and I find no rest. Thus shall you say to him, thus says the Lord, behold, what I have built, I am breaking down, and what I have planted, I am plucking up, that is, the whole land. And do you seek great things for yourself? Seek them not. For behold, I am bringing evil upon all flesh, says the Lord. But I will give you your life as a prize of war in all places to which you may go. Wow, that speaks, that is.
What does it say to you about this?
The whole land is going to pot. You got to stand up and I'll be with you, I guess.
Yeah. He said he read this every night. So maybe that was part of his discipline for obedience. Mm-hmm. You know? He was worried that his seminary would become so ingrown and kind of just a place to be safe and to study well, that it would forget the outside world. So he really inculcated within the discipline that there had to be service for others. So they worked a lot outside the city walls on behalf of the poor and disenfranchised. And later on, there was the threat of imprisonment. If I may just read this little... Is this helpful to hear these little snips, or is it kind of boring? A mother. This is such a sweet, tender, motherly letter. It really touched me. A mother wrote to her son at Finkenwald, who was a student, after visiting one of his friends in prison. This is what the mother writes to her son. I have to take off my glasses now. I find it awful and am sad that it is so. Has it really got to be? Evangelical pastor is written in large letters over the cell door. Every day they are allowed only a half an hour in the fresh air. Bernard Reimer was wonderful and said that things were really not too bad, but I can't believe him because he somehow looks different and he is suffering. When you see your dearest relatives really inside the place, you ask yourself again and again, must it really be so? Is there any other way? I am afraid for you. Reality is hard. May God point the way clearly for you. I don't know why it is, but in spite of your explanations, which at the time seemed quite clear to me, I always return to a different point of view. So this is a mother. She's worried about her son, I think, and knows that he might be in some danger. So Bonhoeffer responds, being a pastor as he is as well as a theologian. He wrote detailed letters to relatives whenever what was called a Finkwaldian was arrested. May I read just a little bit of that letter to the family? It's often difficult for us to grasp God's way with his church, but we may attain peace in the certainty that your son is suffering for the sake of the Lord, and that the Church of Jesus intercedes for him in prayer. The Lord confers great honor on his servants when he brings them suffering. However, we will pray that you place everything in God's hands and that you will give thanks for everything that God may visit on you and his church. So he also invited, if there were any young wives of the seminarians and families, to his house so he could pray with them and be with them. I think this is an example of not only, often you may picture a resistor or somebody who's radical, but I think this is a very loving pastoral letter as well. This is maybe one of his most famous books, The Cost of Discipleship. He gave a lecture at Finkenwald for 2.5 years on discipleship, and people were required to come. And this is really the book of his lectures. This is an excellent book for devotion to read. I had a seminary teacher that said you should read it once a year, and I think it's a good, it would be a good discipline. It's cheap to buy. I don't know how much it is now, but it's a wonderful book. Another book that grew out of his life at Finkenwald was, that he wrote after he left Finkenwald, was called Life Together. And that's a very short, very simple book about our Christian life and community together. And that's a wonderful little book to read, too. He didn't write that at Finkenwald, but wrote it afterwards. Well, just let me read you about his... I keep thinking I wrote down the wrong pages.
It looks like page 45 at My Discipleship.
Yeah. Oh, it's not right, though.
115.
I don't know what it is.
145
or 115.
Well.
How do you make your nines?
I don't know. You see, I have a... No, anyway. What the quote was going to say was that after the seminary was closed, Bonhoeffer was not put in jail. He went home. And he went home with a very close friend of his, and that's where he wrote Life Together. And his parents said, if anything good came out of the Nazis coming and shutting them down, at least our son came home. That was kind of the basis of the letter. He doesn't stay home long, but he stays home for about, I think, 6 or 7 months.
Is he arrested then, or what?
No. Then he gets involved in some ecumenical activity, and then starts to make friends with people who are part of, as Jan put it, the upper echelon in the Nazi
to do away with them.
Party, and then he finds out Hitler's plan and then makes definite plans to join them in the conspiracy to kill Hitler. And then everything is... I think he goes in prison and... I'm not sure about this, but I think it was 1943, and he was killed in 1945.
Gosh.
Just the end of the war. You probably don't have
that. Oh, days before the liberation. Days.
And they knew it was coming. That's why they did it.
Yep. That's right.
How did he discover the plan? The key, that you said the code, they cracked the code, discovered the plan.
Well, he had, Canaris was
the... Canaris was a close friend. Yeah.
Of Hitler, yeah. Yeah, so... I mean, Hitler, one of his big deals was having people he absolutely trusted. I mean, you remember the hideous story of his first round of SA people. He went out and had them all shot. And these are people that, you know, he said he just couldn't trust anymore and then got a whole bunch of new ones. So, but Canaris was highly trusted and knew the plan. So that's where he said that he is a snake.
Yeah,
well, I think this session, we'll stop it now.
Yeah.